So I've been thinking about doing this podcast since yesterday. And as I mentioned to you that I've been doing the whole RC flying, I've gotten back into flying because when I was a kid, my dad actually, my dad and I, we would do helicopters and mostly helicopters and a couple airplanes.
How old were you?
13, 14, 15.
Okay.
About 15 maybe on average. So it's been a while. And then technology's moved along quite a bit since then. But, you know, I got back into it maybe almost a month now into it. And steep learning curve, having to learn a lot of new software and also some of the hardware with new batteries also, you know, because lithium polymer is a big deal now. So a lot of technological advancements have occurred in the last 20 years, and it's been nice to get back into it. And I went flying yesterday.
Okay.
So the specific type of flying that I'm doing now is we call slope soaring, which is basically it's gliding. So we try to fly against the side of the mountain, and there's a hill. Basically, you're standing on the top of the hill, and as the air comes up the hill, it's forced to move upwards.
Mm-hmm. And you're catching that
pocket. You're catching that updraft,
okay.
Right? And so we launch our planes at the top of the hill, and because of that updraft, the plane will stay in the air. And it doesn't need a motor.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need battery or power, anything. So it'll just stay there, and you can actually fly and do a lot of very cool things, acrobatics and you know, just you can soar really high, or you can do a lot of tricks and maneuvers. And I guess what's cool about that is it usually takes a specific amount of wind speed to generate that kind of lift.
It scares me because all I think about is, okay, if I don't catch that wind, am I going to break my plane?
Like, yeah, you're going to. So on a really if there's no air, if there's no wind,
yeah,
you're screwed.
Nosedive,
like,
right?
You're going to throw your plane and it's just going to drop into the abyss of whatever. Hopefully you can walk down this thing. But for example, sometimes if you're standing, you know, like sometimes along the coastline, mm-hmm. there's a huge bluff, right?
Yeah.
A huge cliff. Well, if you launch that and like, what if it flies out into the ocean or,
yeah,
or if
game over?
Game over. It flies down where you can't get it. Same thing where we were standing yesterday. It's this hill out in Pomona. I call it Temple Hill. Well, it's not I call it. It's known as Temple Hill. I took a picture of it. It has a flag blowing up there. And it's pretty goddamn steep when you go down into. I mean, if you lose your plane down the hill, it's recoverable. But it's basically hands and knees type crawling or type climbing.
And what kind of condition is the plane in at that point? If you're going to throw it off the cliff and you're getting a nosedive, I imagine it's 500 pieces or something.
If it's so there's two extremes of the problem. One, if there's no air, no mm-hmm. wind, you're losing it because it can't stay afloat.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of things come into play, such as the plane's weight and also the size of the wing. And then in conjunction, we call that wing loading. Basically, how much weight is it carrying per square foot of wing mm-hmm. wingspan? Obviously, the less weight per area wing, then the more it'll float, the easier it is to get that plane to float. So
probably easier to recover too, right? Like if it starts diving and you can adjust.
You know, I think you're right. I think the lighter the wing loading is, you know, the less weight it has to bear, the slower it generally flies.
Okay.
So it's easier to get it to basically sit, you know, or stay in one place.
How do you start it? Do you just throw it?
Like, yeah, you fucking launch it. there's a couple ways. I mean, if it's windy enough, you can it will literally pick the plane up off of your hands.
Oh, okay.
Right. So on a good day, so I was saying like a worst case scenario is there's no wind.
Okay.
In which case you should probably not fly because your plane's not going to fly. It has no motor.
Right.
And on the other opposite end of the spectrum, if it's super windy, and that's the story I'm about to tell, is you're going to lose your plane because you have no control over it. But on an average day where you have just enough lift, enough air,
mm-hmm.
you could literally hold it and you can feel it. The air is pulling your plane out of your hands.
Hmm.
You just have to let go.
It's based on the shape of the wings and how you're about to throw it.
Airfoil, aerodynamics, you know,
that's cool.
Bernoulli's principle, all of these things, right? So the story basically goes, yesterday we went, and as you know, LA, we've been in the middle of a storm.
Oh yeah, yesterday was really windy.
Super windy. Yeah. And I've been tracking this thing since early last week or so, because you could see it coming. And
so is this good? Is this like surfing when you're like, all right, there's going to be a storm?
I thought it was good. I thought it was going to be awesome. I thought it was like, great. This is going to be like having a great swell come in.
Yeah.
It's going to be, you know, all our planes are going to fly. I was a little concerned that the wind was going to be a little strong.
Mm-hmm.
So I started prepping for that. And the way you prep for that is I start to load up the planes with a little bit of ballast, dead weight.
Okay.
To try to make them heavier and
like a counterweight or something.
Counterweight,
yeah.
to try to fight the force of the wind.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, you could have flown a brick yesterday.
Really?
Yeah, you could have flown a brick. You could have flown a refrigerator yesterday. In fact, the flag that was standing or blowing actually fell. It was so
wow.
strong.
Was it popular that day? Was like crowded in
no.
that area?
And that's when you know it's a bad
okay.
idea.
Yeah.
And any
you're the one guy going out surfing, you'd see a wall.
That's exactly what happened when I almost died. I was one of 10 guys who were probably all pro. And you know, when you're going to a place like El Porto and it's like supposed to be 1,000 people in the water and you only see 10 guys, there's a reason there's only
yeah.
10 guys. Likewise, yesterday, me, Johnny and I went, we were the only people out there. And I mean, that place is not super popular, but you would
think. But on the weekend?
On a Sunday afternoon, there should definitely be people there. Cause
and the sun is at least out for a little while, right?
It was, yeah. I mean, we planned to be there out at 1 or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We're just trying to beat the rain.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when we got out there, it was so gusty. I mean, we're talking about, Johnny claims it was 30, 35. Mile an hour winds, and we're flying things that are very, very light. They're made of foam. They're supposed to float.
Sure.
And even before he arrived, I got there a little early, and what happened was, as I was setting up the plane, I was just holding it, and it literally blew out of my hands. It blew vertically. It basically came belly up,
yeah.
And then the wind was pushing it. Basically did a backflip right out of my hands
oh.
and into the dirt. Batteries came out. Crack the pod of the front that was holding the batteries, basically the nose of the plane. And even before I even meant to launch it, I already had a mishap.
It's like the rocket going off on the ground. Like,
yeah, it was bad. It was definitely.
How much time does it take to put that back together? Like, I would be so mad at that point.
I mean, it's like when you're out on location and you're ready to shoot, rain or shine, and whether or not you have all your stuff about you, whether
mm-hmm.
or not you're ready, you're going to do it. You're going to make it work. And so I put it back together. I taped it up. Like I needed to put it back together.
And now how do you feel like the...
not good.
Okay.
Definitely not confident.
Like you wouldn't fly in this plane at this point. Like if you saw a plane with some tape on it on the side, you'd be wrecked as a passenger. In this storm, like
or yeah, if it were a passenger plane, you would never fly in that condition.
Oof. Okay.
And I mean, if a passenger plane had to endure what my plane was going to endure, there's no way. There's zero chance that anybody would make that decision to fly, because it's about 50-50 if this thing's going to land.
So how confident at this point are you that you're going to take your plane back? Like you're going to, it's in one piece, you're going to get to leave with it.
50-50. And that's really giving it a generous.
Okay.
Like. When my plane crashed before I even launched it.
Yeah. That's
like
trouble.
Before that, I would have said, oh, you know, I think like 80% chance I'm going to go home.
Okay.
And on any given day, it's probably about 80% chance you're going home with the plane.
Okay.
How so there's always that risk.
How do mechanics work? So you throw it, right? And then you have to scramble to get the controller after that? Like, is it in your other hand?
It's in my other hand
okay.
already.
So the plane's not heavy enough to where it's two hands
no.
and you got to, okay.
So we're talking about a plane with a wingspan of about 59 inches, which
mm-hmm.
is, you know, you're talking about less than 6 feet. So about 5 feet.
Pretty big.
I'm sorry, even
like
less
a
than
hawk.
5 feet. 5 feet would be 60 inches.
Okay.
Exactly less than 5 feet.
Okay.
Pretty big. Pretty big. Doesn't weigh a whole lot. You're looking at this one was 18 ounces, so just over a pound.
Mm-hmm.
Pound and 2 ounces. And, in 30, 35 mile an hour winds, this thing is going to fucking fly. So I tape it up and I'm like, okay, now I went from 80% chance. Now I'm feeling a little hesitant, 50%. I launch it. and it flies. It is vibrating and shaking like hell, though.
You can see it.
Like,
yeah.
It is, it's like a butterfly in a gust of wind.
Okay.
It is really hanging on for dear life, but I'm fighting, I'm controlling it. I'm like, okay, this is going okay. And I start to go back and forth along the slope of the mm-hmm. hill. And I'm like, okay, I'm gaining confidence. All right, this is good. We got this, right?
What are you worried about at that point when you're flying it? Like, what's going to be the catastrophe that you're avoiding?
The big, big catastrophe, the number one thing that I am very, very, it's on my mind, is don't fly it to the backside of the hill. So as any hill is shaped, you've got a coming, your front side, back side. So on the front side, the air is coming up. The back side, the air is going down.
Yeah.
We call that sink. So if you fly it on the back side and the air is pushing down, you're going to lose it. It's going to crash.
Okay.
It has no motor. It's not coming back.
All right.
So if you pass the crest of the hill
and
it's behind you, you're screwed. That's the number one thing on my mind. Now I'm flying it. I'm gaining confidence. I'm getting some turns out of it. It's kind of like surfing. It's actually very, very much like surfing, which is why I like it so much. It's very. I mean, it's wind powered. You mm-hmm. know, it's natural, just like waves. They're natural. You don't need a motor. It's just a board and you, and you're just taking off, and everything is geo powered. You know, so
it has to be in harmony too, like in
it's
surfing.
Harmony.
You,
it's
you
total
have to
harmony.
Go with the nature. Yeah.
You don't fight it. You have to go with it. And so I'm carving up and down the slope. It's just turning up and down and up and down as you know you're using the air that's coming up, and I'm gaining a lot of confidence. I'm like, cool, this is awesome. And then I'm like, I'm gonna go higher. And then this is where shit hits the fan is as I go higher.
What's higher? How high?
Dude, not that high. Maybe like 100 feet.
Okay. That seems
high
to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, 100 feet is high for human beings, but, you know, for birds and aircraft, I mean, you're talking about several hundred feet, mm-hmm. you know, and if you can find thermals, like the eagles are soaring around, they're like 1,000 feet up in the air. So 100 feet is not much. But what happens is, as I'm coming up and finding that 100 feet of air, I don't know why, but the wind speed up there is just so much greater.
Hmm.
And it gets to the point where my plane is facing forward, but actually moving backwards.
Wow.
So it doesn't have enough what we call penetration to actually even stay still. It's one thing to hover and stay still because the wind is equivalent, is creating enough lift where... you know, just like the same
frozen almost
frozen
in the
yeah,
sky,
the same
yeah.
speed at which you would move forward, but now it's actually moving backwards.
Yeah,
and as it's moving backwards, now I'm screwed because now it's pushing my plane into the backside of the mountain where there is sink.
So what's the first thing you
down?
Okay,
move down, dive.
So you're cutting it at an angle,
trying to cut down, trying to cut through the air, trying to get some airspeed so that first of all. I can move forward.
Yeah.
But secondly, it's like getting sucked into the black hole.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh shit. It's moving backwards and it's moving into the backside of the mountain where I know I'm going to lose it. And I'm trying to dive her down. But as I dive her down, I might have given her too much input. And then I pull up. And now as she's coming up, now her belly is up against the wind. And exactly the same thing that happened
not
earlier. The wind is just pushing up against the belly
You're
of
vertical,
the plane.
Like the...
And now it's a big backflip.
Okay.
Big old backflip. And then I try to catch her, try to save it. And,
with your hand?
No. I'm trying to save it by letting her do the backflip.
Okay. Let it go all the way around, try to adjust afterwards.
Letting her do the whole backflip, trying to ride her again and trying to get her stabilized. And I think I did that once or twice, but what happens is quickly it disappears under the horizon of the hill. So now I can't even see it anymore.
Okay.
So it's no longer within my view, and now I'm operating off of what I think the plane is doing.
Right. You hope that it's either right side up or upside down. You got to guess. Yeah.
And I make some knee-jerk reactions, panic mode things where I'm like, okay, fine, just pull up.
Are you running just in that direction as well? Like
I did that maybe last week when I crashed. I ran that way as it was crashing, but this time I waited until I was much less panicked this time, and I was trying to save it. I thought maybe there was a small chance I could save it. I didn't run, so I was actually still standing in place. I was just looking in that direction. I couldn't see it anymore. The last time I saw it, it was belly up again, and so I could only assume that it did another backflip. Again, when this is happening, we're talking about super gusty wind, knee-jerk reactions in a pilot that is still trying to learn how to do this. So anyway, long story short, she crashed. And she probably crashed maybe 50 yards from where I was.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't find her. I mean, I walked as far as, I think I was 400 yards away. And
wow.
I had looked for maybe 25 minutes, 30 minutes maybe even.
Mm-hmm.
I was so far away from my, I was probably 100 yards down.
Okay, so you're walking down the hill right now.
Oh, yeah. And this is hands and knees crawling.
Because it's that
stuff.
Steep.
It's so steep.
Okay.
It's brushy. I'm just trampling through the brush.
Is Johnny there yet?
Johnny's on the top, and he was.
And this is the first flight.
First flight.
Yeah.
And he was prepping his plane. But yeah. And apparently after I crashed, he literally put all his shit away. Like,
oh, God.
He was like, I'm not flying today, which is actually part of the story. And so I'm 400 yards away horizontally. I'm 100 yards down looking for my plane. And the good thing is my radio, the controller, has what we call telemetry.
Okay.
It has a battery. It knows how much battery is left on the airplane
because
it sends that signal back. But I lost the telemetry, which means that I don't have a direct line of sight to this airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So it's either over the hill or it's lost power one way or another. Like I don't have I don't know where it is anymore. It's
the black box is missing now.
Yeah. The black box is turned off. Whereas earlier was giving a signal. And so I kept looking. I looked for 25 minutes. And then actually I hear Johnny from like 400 yards, not 400 yards, but maybe about 300. He was yelling and I could barely hear him.
Cause it's so windy or you're that far away.
It was that far away.
Okay.
And he was waving and I was like, what are you waving for? And he actually held up what looked like my plane. I couldn't even see. It was that far away. I couldn't really tell if it was or wasn't.
Did he go off to look or was he originally at the same spot?
He was originally standing right next to me. And after I had gone looking for it, I think he went to go look for it too.
Mm-hmm.
And he found it. He said it was only like 50 yards away from where I had been standing, which is probably about right. It's one of those things where when you go off into the forest, you start walking and then like you lose your bearings. Completely you lose your bearings and you don't know where you are, which direction you're going, how far you are away, all the coordinates and your relativity of where everything is, it's gone. So Johnny had a much better sense of where it was, and he found it maybe 50 yards from where we were.
It's even like golf, though. Like you'll see when
I know, exactly.
People go out.
It's exactly.
You
like
go
golf.
Up on the hill and you think, all right, it had to go this far.
Right.
And now you're 150 feet away from anywhere it could have landed.
Right.
And you're like, well, all right, I have no idea. And there'll be your friend will find it because they were more on course.
Exactly. Little angles that you have assumed that it's gone in one direction turn out to be huge, huge.
You're
gaps.
Assuming bounces or even if the plane rolls or hits a tree a certain way.
Right. So anyway, so I'm like, and then when he finds it, I am covered in sweat. I am literally sweating so hard because, I mean, literally it was one of the best workouts.
Yeah.
I mean, climbing up those kind of hills is fantastic for cardio. My legs were burning.
Yeah.
I'd been on literally like a 45 incline, you know, hands and knees climbing through the bushes. And I'm pissed. I'm fucking pissed. Because on one hand, I'm relieved. You know, on the other hand, a part of my heart was like, dude, there's a good chance you lost it. You're never going to see it again.
Ugh.
For whatever reason, I thought it had maybe blown all the way down the hill into the cul-de-sac where people lived. That would have been a quarter mile away, but
it really or it hits a roof, and now you got to knock on someone's door to get that down.
But anyway, so he finds it. I climb all the way back the hill, and then he's like, "Yeah, I'm not flying today." He put all his shit away. He's like, "Once I saw you crash, I put everything back," and I'm like, "I can't fly." And the thing is, his plane is much heavier.
Okay.
And if I were him, I would have flown.
Because you might have some more control, right?
Because you would have had much more control.
What does your plane look like now after that crash?
It's that crack that was in the pod, the nose of the plane.
Yeah.
Is now completely ripped. It's like a bigger crack.
Oh, okay.
And without tape, it would not fly. And without putting everything now, can it fly? I could. I have enough tape. I can put it all back together. It'll work if I have the balls to do so.
Well, how much risk do you want to take, too? Do you want to destroy it completely?
And that's what Johnny was saying. Johnny was like, dude, this mine, I'm not willing to throw a $300 plane out mm-hmm. and have it just, you know, risk it crashing. And mine wasn't $300. It wasn't, you know, it was like maybe $150 all in or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not terribly cheap, but certainly not expensive. And I'm like, let's try again. I'm like, one more time, awesome. One more time. And he's like, dude, you are just a glutton for pain. I'm like, I didn't come here not to fly.
Yeah.
You know, I came here, I had expectations. I'm flying today, goddammit. And it's got to go the way that I thought it was going to go. And that's my attitude. And that's what, actually, it took me so goddamn long to tell the story, but it's so funny. But this is not the crux of what I was trying to say. It was just the beginning. And, and so okay, I'm not stupid. I'm not just going to taper up and launch her off the same goddamn cliff again with 35-mile-an-hour winds. I know the same thing will happen. So
what's your plan now?
It's exactly the same as surfing. So if it's too big when it's exposed,
mm-hmm.
find where it's not as exposed, you know, between the jetty.
You're getting smaller sets.
Okay. Less exposed, you know, it's breaking on the jetty and then it's smaller or whatever. So we walk back towards the car where we're lower on the hill, we're less exposed to the wind, and I'm like, all right, here.
Mm-hmm.
we taper up, launch the plane, and...
Does it control different now with the crack in it?
It's not flying well, and okay. I'm not sure exactly why. It could be...
Like a flat tire, basically. You've lost control of the car a little bit.
Yeah, she's not looking good, and I don't know what else is going on. I mean, dude, she's not going to fly great with, like, six pieces of packaging tape on her nose, you know, like aerodynamically she's not the same thing. But
so it feels like drag or something, or
it doesn't fly. It's she's not doing well. Okay. And it's like having a sick horse, you know, in a horse race. And I throw her and then she's flying, but she's fluttering, and she's still, I mean, the wind there is maybe 10 miles an hour or less,
mm-hmm.
but very inconsistent, because now that we've found a lot of coverage, so to speak, there were trees on my left, there were houses down below, and the hill is higher on my right. There's not the type of consistent airspeed to keep her afloat. And within a minute or less, I couldn't keep her in the air, and she actually crashes again.
Hmm.
So it's almost the opposite, where I wasn't getting enough lift. And so she crashes into the brush, and I'm like, all right, so this is it. This mm-hmm. is good. I'm good. I've already crashed three times. I crashed before I launched. I crashed twice after launching. And I will finally admit defeat. So I go home and I patch her up, and that's that story. So what's the significance of the story? Why do I even bring this up? Why do I tell this story? I was thinking, first of all, it's very different from Johnny's experience. Johnny mm-hmm. went there and he drove really far. He went from Santa Monica to Pomona. You're looking at about
that is a trek.
A 45-mile
no
drive.
Traffic, that's a trek.
45 miles. I mean, possibly more, possibly less, but around there.
Through the heart of LA. It's going to take a while to get there.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I mean, he drove with on a weekend, okay. so it's not like he sat in 2 hours of traffic, which it could have very well been.
Yeah.
I think we went there on Friday afternoon, and it took him probably an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Okay.
So it's far. But he went all the way there, and he put all his shit away, and he went home. I would never do that. It's not me, and I'm not saying anything bad about him. It's nothing on him. It's just a difference in style, attitude, expectations. Not only did I launch the plane, I launched it twice, and I even after I almost lost it.
Mm-hmm.
And so my thing is, I didn't go there not to fly. I mm-hmm. have to fly. I have to do this. I'm too close. I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
I waited all weekend or whatever. I didn't, you know, I prepped.
Do you learn something from it when you were flying? Like, do you feel like it as you're piloting it, that experience helps you?
Yeah, I mean, it's the failures, of course. It's losing it to the backside of the mountain, not once but twice. It's also flying in the wind speed that's too great for your plane to bear. And you know, you learn like kind of boundaries. You know, mm-hmm. you mentally create kind of, you know, go no go situations. And maybe that's why Johnny, having a little bit more experience, he said he's lost plenty of planes and he wasn't willing to. And I don't know. I mean, for me, it's a, I can tell I'm a gambler. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. so close. I'm like, I'm there. I have to. It's not a question. I have to do this.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I flew, Dude, I was in like a middle school baseball field next to my house, and in retrospect, there's no way I had enough space to fly. And I had just put the plane together. I didn't know what I was doing, and I launched it 8 times, and I crashed it 8 times. I'm lucky I got the plane back, but because each time I crashed it, you know, I, at the end of the day, the foam was all messed up, and like I broken a servo. You know, I had broken a lot of things, and even had I got it in the air, there was not enough physical space to fly. But I couldn't leave. Yeah. I couldn't physically get myself to leave, pack up, go home. You know, go back to the quote-unquote drawing boards. I just couldn't get myself to do that.
What are you chasing at that point?
I'm chasing the expectation of success. It's not the actual success. It's the expectation that this is how it went in my head, and this is how it's supposed to, and this is what I want to make work. And it's really strange where that thing is so compelling that I can't stop. And that's the story that I really wanted to tell. It's that gambler's mentality.
Yeah.
Just one more. I can get it. I can make it. And in this case, it is gambling. I'm not gambling with money. I'm gambling with a plane.
Right.
I'm gambling with my time. I'm gambling if I'm going to crash or not. But
are you even thinking about trying to land it?
I'm not. Am I thinking about like, if it will land?
Yeah, because like, okay, so it's a gamble, right?
Right.
And you're going up, but is it more like Point Break, that movie where he wants to go into the storm.
The final scene?
Yeah, like
no, it's
not. He's not paddling back. Like
is no, it's not.
When the wind is that bad, though, like you're like, okay, no, well, I'm gonna be able to land.
I could land it. Okay. I have ridiculously a confidence and an expectation
where Gianni
that
won't even take it out. Yeah,
things are gonna go really well, and that I can control this thing and land her safely, and it is totally unfounded. That confidence and that expectation in that situation is ridiculous.
You doubled down. Like, you were already
flying, right?
You're already flying. You're like, I'm going to go higher. At that point, you could have already landed and started again and done another bet. But that wasn't enough. You wanted to fly. Now I'm going to go higher. And now I've doubled down on these cards because
I guess I can
do this and I'm going to go higher.
But, I mean, that part I don't feel like was that bad because things were going well.
Yeah.
And I'd been out there. It wasn't the first time I'd been out there. And I'd flown that thing out there in lesser wind and... I felt, at least when she was flying and then, you know, at the lower altitude, things were going really, really well.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, I'm like, I'm going to go farther. I'm going to go higher. And then it's just so sudden. Like, she wasn't even moving forward anymore. She's just moving backwards at a pretty good clip, too. And that's when I was like, uh-oh, this is really, really bad. But as far as the expectation before I launched was, okay, 80-20, I'm going to launch it. 20%, I'm going to totally lose it. And then on the third flight, it was... so the first flight it was 80-20. The first flight was before I launched it, you know, when it crashed.
Jumps out of your hand, yeah.
I would have said... So if that didn't happen, if I was able to successfully launch it without her even, like, you know, crashing before I launched... On any given day, you're talking about 80-20, 85-15, success to failure. But because she already crashed, now it's like, all right, maybe 50-50. So already going into that first actual flight, 50-50, I was going to lose her. And then on the third flight where I had to go down to the lower area to fly
more of a controlled area.
More controlled area. I was like, yeah, it's again 50-50. And anytime it's 50-50, I'm willing to take that bet. And that's the thing is when I'm in that position, I'm willing to take bets that are really bad. Like 25-30% success rate. I'm like, all right, I'm in. I'll do it. You know, I feel... You feel like you have to chase that bet. You have to... And it really is gambler's mentality. It's like, I have to. I can do this. We can win. Come on. I know the odds are against us, but we've got 25%. And right. I'm just focusing on what we can get out of it, which is, in my head, I'd built this up over the last couple of days that this is going to go really well.
Yeah, and now it's going well on the first run. And you saw a king. You're like, I'm going to double down.
Yeah, and then it flew up into the air, and then I lost her to the backside of the mountain. And then I was like, well, if I didn't do that, it would have been fine. I thought everything was going well, so we just need to find lesser air.
Yeah.
Less wind, and then we'll be okay. You know, historically, that works well for me. And I think that's the part of the story I want to tell. And I can't believe we're already in like 30 minutes into this. But the reason is, yeah, I guess part of me is a gambler, and part of me is a glutton, as Johnny would say, a glutton for pain. I need that because I'm willing to lose the plane.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to have the problem of, even if I do find the plane, I have to put it back together and it'll take me like 5 hours or whatever. I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to make that sacrifice because for me, it's that expectation. It's that, I came so far to do this. I'm not going to walk away. It's also that I like that problem. I like problems. Mm-hmm. I like thinking about, well, what went wrong? Or I like thinking about, well, how am I going to put this back together? There's something where my mind needs that friction. It mm-hmm. needs to be constantly working on something where it allows me to live more fulfilled because I'm fighting against something. So, and sometimes I think I'm very combative, or I'm like a belligerent, not physically, but in the sense that I need an opponent. I need a a game that I'm playing against an opponent. And in this case, of course, it's the wind and it's the probability of getting the plane back. But I needed that, and whether or not I was going to win or not, I was willing to play because I needed to play that game.
What also probably teaches you a lot. Like, in my mind, any sport, and this kind of reminds me of sports.
Yeah,
like,
it is exactly sports.
Like, when you're snowboarding, you're learning how to snowboard, you have to fall. That's the way it goes. You have to fall. Otherwise, you're never going to get better. I that sounds weird, but that's how I learned, and that's how I've seen a lot of people learn.
8 hours on the side on the bunny slopes on the first day that I snowboarded, and the next day I was wrecked. My whole body was wrecked.
Yeah, but you know now, like, you learned so much about yourself and the board and the experience.
Yep.
The next day is going to be easier.
Yeah. So I think you're absolutely right in the sense of learning anything, you have to be able to fail.
And it can be painful. Like, I remember my buddy, Greg, is one of the most, he played football for a long time, got hurt, mm-hmm. went over and came with the rest of our friends to play hockey. And he was super aggressive. He's the guy that will do whatever that needs to happen. He didn't know how to stop. Yeah. He didn't know how to stop on skates yet.
Yeah.
Didn't matter. It took him probably a fourth of the time to get as good as he needed to get to our team, what was the varsity team, because he decided, I'm going to go through this. Like, he would slam into the board so hard to where you know that either he's hurt, both of the guys are hurt that he's checking, but he doesn't even try to check them. That's how he stopped. He was slamming against the boards. But eventually, through doing that, he learned, and he got better.
You learn really fast like that.
So fast.
That's what I envy about the kids, because when the kids fall, it doesn't hurt as much, mm-hmm. And so they have a shorter learning, basically a much better learning curve, because they can try again, pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and do it again. My wife says often to me, you don't know when to stop. You don't know when to quit. And don't get me wrong. That's not all good. There's plenty of bad things that come along with that. For example, like I told you about the trampoline incident, right? At the San Dimas
Jumping? Yeah.
Is that what's...
I did the same
what's
thing.
What's that called?
Yeah. Rock and Jump, I think.
Rock and Jump, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a trampoline park. So I'm like, I'm going to do... I want to do a backflip on the trampoline, but first I'm going to do it off into the foam pit. And I did it into the foam pit. And I've done this into the swimming pool many a time. And this is the second time I jumped, and I was going to do two backflips into the foam pit and then try to do it on the trampoline. Well, second time I did it into the foam pit, I somehow pulled a Greg Louganis.
Oh.
I didn't clear the ledge I was standing on.
Yeah.
And I went neck and head first into the platform.
Which is padded, but it's still a hard shot. It's solid.
Yeah. It is solid. It's padded by an inch of padding, but underneath it is...
Probably metal or cement. Not cement. Probably metal piping.
Yeah. I mean, it's just flooring.
It's a hard hit. It's like a boxing glove.
And when I struck it, I heard all sorts of cracks, like things popping, and I literally thought I was severely injured when I landed in the foam pit, because when I flipped and then I landed head first, it was like being struck by lightning. It was like being hit by a car, because first of all, my whole body was relaxed.
Yeah.
I was expecting a soft landing.
Yeah.
Just like the one 3 minutes before that. Just like every other time I've ever done a backflip into a pool. I've never, ever struck the platform. But this time I went head and neck first into it, and I bounced off of it and landed in the foam pit. Ugh. And I literally stayed in the foam pit for maybe 2 minutes because I wasn't sure I was going to be able to walk out of the foam pit.
You probably heard noises in your neck. Like when you, it's weird when you can internally hear those noises. Yep. That's a bad sign.
It's really bad.
Yeah.
Any normal person would have said, I'm done for the day. Mm-hmm. Let's go home. 5 minutes after that, I tried again. And so this time I actually tried on the trampoline and I face planted into the trampoline because I didn't rotate fully backflip. Yeah. And also didn't do it wasn't directly backwards. It was kind of like off to one side.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of landed on one side and then face planted again. And any normal person after that would have called it quits, but I did it again. And I know I'm taking those risks, but I was just like, well, first of all, you walk off the pain, and any person who's, you know, self-respecting and a sportsman, you know, walk it off. You'll be okay. Don't worry about it.
And you're assessing yourself while you're doing it. You're probably moving your neck around to see, okay, well, how bad is it?
It wasn't terrible. Right. Right. I was like,
your body's probably still in shock though, too.
It's still in shock.
So yeah, you don't really know how bad it is.
I mean, I'll tell you how bad. So I did it 3 times and each time I pretty much face planted, but the first time was absolutely the worst. It felt like getting struck by a car. And to put into perspective of how badly I was injured, I literally 3 days later, every day after that, I was in pain and I was like, if this persists, I have to go to the chiropractor. And on the third day, I bent over, I forget, pick something up, tie my shoelaces, and my whole neck and back seized. And I thought I wouldn't be able to stand upright anymore. Ugh. It seized up and it's never happened to me before. And immediately I made an appointment to go see a chiropractor because I was really fucked. And then to this day, I really have limited range of motion to my right side because I can't turn my neck all the way right. It's either scar tissue or still some tendon ligament damage. So that's the kind of guy that I am. And that's a huge failure, you know. It happens because, again, I don't know when to stop. But there are plenty of times when it works really well for me where, you know, just if you just push through that thin barrier, you're clear.
How motivated
you made
are you?
It,
yeah.
You know?
How bad do you want something? What are you willing to do for it?
I mean, if I had landed correctly, dude, I would have been bouncing around like, you know.
Yeah, you would have got hurt later because you would have tried something crazier.
Yeah, but I would have been flying. I would have been doing the thing that I've, you know, in my whole life, backflipping had been a big deal because I didn't do gymnastics. I don't have that flexibility to do handsprings.
Yeah.
But I have the athleticism to do those things and to do backflips. So I've always envied anything that can stay in the air. So whether it's snowboarding and trying to clear huge tabletops. Dude, I was clearing like 20, 30 foot tabletops when I was, 17, 18. I wasn't able to do anything. Like I wasn't doing 360s or 720s, but I was able to clear them.
That feeling's great too. The anticipation of it, of everything. Yeah.
The anticipation is mind blowing.
Makes
adrenaline.
My hands sweat just thinking about it. Like that feeling of like, all right, I'm next and you got to go.
Yep, because it is. Yeah. You got to wait your turn.
The balance that you have to have, you're like, all right, how am I going to prepare myself for this jump? Same with the flip too. You're like, all right, well, I'm going to do this.
Everything matters up until the point that you're in the air. And once you're in the air, you basically have like no control. So everything has to be perfect. Your trajectory, your launch, and everything is calculated. And once you're in the air, it's everything that it's all the prep work's been done.
It's just conviction to that prep work.
Yes. You have to, and you have to believe that this
is going. You can't bail.
If you have an ounce of doubt, it's going to end badly.
Yeah,
every time.
You see people moving. They'll adjust.
They try to correct or they try. It's like trying to turn when you're on a fun box. Have you ever tried to turn on a plastic fun box or a rail?
Oh, yeah. They're plastic on top. Yeah. Sometimes they'll have the rails on the side.
If you're trying to turn on the rail, you're screwed.
Mm-hmm.
You have to just ride the rail straight and believe that it's going to stay. You're going to be okay. The moment you try to correct or try to turn, your whole board comes from underneath.
It's Wile E. Coyote trying to run in midair, trying to get back to the cliff.
So it's, you know, why is that story important? Is because flying through the air has always been huge for me. I've always wanted, when I was on roller skates, I'd try to make jumps. When I was on snowboards, I try to get, you know, try to get airtime. When I was playing basketball, volleyball, you know, grabbing the rim or whatever, trying to dunk, you know, and then it also goes back to why I'm flying remote control planes is I love things that can defy gravity. There's that freedom. In my dreams at night, I still dream about not just dunking, but flying, you know, sometimes. And so there's that thing where if I can just clear this thing, this one little barrier, just punch through, I've got it. Whether it's a backflip or keeping that plane in the air, you know, or just flying off of that tabletop. So it's worked historically. And then I know those are all sports. Those are all examples of sports where it's worked for me. But the other example is like when, and I think I've mentioned hosting Counter-Strike servers back when I was in college. And for me, it was, it's the same type of obsession, you know. It doesn't give me the same adrenaline rush, but it's the same type of problem solving that I implemented to be able to think through how to run a successful server. I mean, my server was top five, I think, in the world at the time because of how many players I could. First of all, I was hosting 35 on 35. I'm sorry, was it 35 on 35? Yeah, it was the maximum size of the server at the time was 35. And I had a full server. I had people coming from around the world. I implemented statistics. I had a modification that would give people administration rights. I saved spaces for my friends, and I was, you know, we were doing all sorts of crazy things. We had like a anti-cheat scripts activated. It was a full boat, a full house type of server. And I remember many times during that time when I was running that server, when things would break. A new version of Counter-Strike would come out. You'd have to wait for the new versions of the anti-cheats, the mods, the scripts, and everything to come out. And half the time it was like, it didn't work. It didn't work properly because something about it would be broken. All of Counter-Strike at the time was beta. 7.0, I believe, after 7.0 was when Counter-Strike actually was purchased by Valve, the company that makes Half-Life. And then they were actually officially... finally a real product. But up until that time, basically everything was, it was a user generated, user created community with everything was user generated. The skins, the guns.
Does it fall apart one day? Like what is the thing that if it needs an update or something like that, the whole thing shuts down or there's glitches?
Well, it's like when you the closest thing I can think of is when you get an update from Apple on your iPhone saying you have to upgrade to the newest software. Well, some of your apps stop working.
Yeah, everything might be running slower or...
Yeah, there might be glitches, it might be slow, or they might not even open at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an Apple product. That is stable as hell.
So many levels of people that have to keep that working.
Counter-Strike was the equivalent of trying to get a 1992 PC to not crash when you booted a game or installed a new Sound Blaster sound card. I mean, the chances of things going wrong were astronomical. And we were always troubleshooting, always trying to fix something, always trying to catch cheaters. I had an intake fan that was maybe 6 inches wide stuck to the inside of my PC because I was overclocking the PC. And that was another aspect of it, hardware. I was overclocking and trying to blow air onto the CPU to keep it cool at all times. So
is it the culmination of everything? Is that similar to being in the air?
It is. Okay. It's because you know you are basically defying all sorts of rules.
Because like, everything has to go right.
That fan, you have to understand, that fan was made for my car. I took that fan and I soldered the wiring up to the motherboard. That's not how that thing's supposed to work.
Yeah.
There's no computer out there that has a 6-inch intake fan that sounds like a freaking aircraft carrier sucking air into it. That's not how those things work. Likewise, Counter-Strike, those mods, those scripts, whether it was anti-cheating, anti-hacking, or trying to implement the newest version of, it was called admin mod, where you could do God mode, you could do like teleportation, you know, all those stories I was telling you about.
You're keeping the ship together. You're keeping the plane together.
And it's a very fragile plane.
Yeah.
It's a plane that is flying by duct tape and
Because anything, not you lose one part air. Of it, it all falls apart. That fan breaks, or if there's a new cheat that destroys the game,
right,
basically
exactly.
Because it's too good.
It's a
over.
Very delicate balance that by which you're skating by the, you know, on thin ice that things are, but there's that hope, there's that dream that it can be done. And mm-hmm. it's that, you know, it's the same feeling that I get when I'm pushing the boundaries for whether it's photography or whether it's snowboarding or flying the plane. I know it's not supposed to be like this, and I know you're not supposed to fly in 35 mile an hour wind, but I'm going to do it anyway, and mm-hmm. I'm going to try it. If I fail, I fail. You know, if I have to put it back together, at least I don't go home and say, oh, you know, I didn't try. I don't mm-hmm. know. I don't know what would happen. Maybe it would have been okay. But I can't live with myself if I do that. There's only two.
I can see that.
The two biggest regrets I have in my life. One, I didn't try out for varsity basketball after I got cut the first time. That's one of the biggest regrets. I think that shaped my life indefinitely, because there's a part of me that did fail and that didn't get up and didn't try again. So I tried out, I think it was in ninth grade, and then I didn't get into, I think it was JV at the time. And when 10th grade rolled around, I didn't try it out again.
It wrecked me.
Yeah. My confidence was gone.
Yeah.
And even though.
Was anyone else telling you to do it?
No, I don't remember. I think I would have if the other guys, I don't know why in my mind, I just felt like, I think it was a little bit of a sour grapes issue. Mm-hmm. It was like, nah, I don't need to. I don't, you know, it's cool. I'm okay with that. I don't need it. And I'd been playing basketball. I'd still played, but all between the time that, you know, I got cut and then the new tryouts came around, I kept playing.
Yeah.
And I had a friend that got cut the same time I got cut in ninth grade, and he tried out again and he made it.
Did his skill level go up? Did yours go up?
I think both of ours did. But his his desire to pursue and commit and persist mm-hmm. paid off. And I think he's a bigger man for it. He's, you know, it changed. It was a fork in the road that changed both of our lives forever. And I don't think about it a whole lot, but I think it says a lot about you when you don't get up and you don't try, you know, or you don't persist after you failed.
It's interesting, though, because I hear that a lot, like that the regret part of it. But maybe that feeling that you have that it was agonizing, that you didn't want to do it, knowing now that you should have done it, that you have that fuel in you. It's a different kind of thing. It's saying, I'm not going to do that again.
Yeah.
I'm not going to feel like that again. And I'm going to go out and try.
Yeah.
Because you could have gone out and made it, right?
But it was weird. It was like...
Wouldn't it be as pivotal, probably?
No, it would have been fine. Even if I had gotten cut again, I think it would have been... At least I said I tried, mm-hmm. you know? And to this day, I don't make it a big deal. It doesn't even stand out as a big deal in my head. But it's one of those things where, because you didn't, now you know, you'll never know.
Right.
You'll never know how your life could have been different. You'll never know how it could have been better. You'll never know how much more respect you would have had for yourself if you did, and whether or not you made it or not. It doesn't matter.
Right. But also, what did you do because of it? Because now, what
right.
what
my whole life is different. That fork in the road yeah. is going off in a different direction.
What were you motivated to do because you didn't do that?
Now, I found great success in other sports. Mm-hmm. I played volleyball for 3 years. I didn't even try out the first year, so I would have played 4 years if I had tried out. I played badminton. I was the first seed for 3 out of the 4 years. So it's not like I didn't find success elsewhere. It's just that I should have never quit that, because that thing meant a lot to me. And another example that I have, you know, so that one I don't dream about. But the one I do dream about is the car that I had that I modified to death, and I couldn't get her running. And I couldn't get her running right. And I ran out of time. I ran out of resources. I don't know if I told this story. I probably have. And ultimately wound up donating the car to charity. And at a huge, huge loss, because I probably spent, you know, I don't know, maybe all in, including the car itself, over $100,000.
Oh, that's the gamble. Like, maybe it's good that you stopped at one point.
Right,
like
right.
You're at the table and you're losing money on playing blackjack. But
right.
At that point, when do you quit? When do you go get more money?
Yeah, I mean, I was how many years in? 5 years in, 6 years into that journey, and just hemorrhaging money because I couldn't get her to run, but I wouldn't give up. Kept trying to fix her, kept hiring other people to try to do it. And it, the smart decision that I don't think I should regret is that you got to know when to stop. You got to know when to pull the plug on life support and say goodbye. Problem is, that doesn't reconcile the fact that you had to say goodbye to something that you loved dearly and you really, you wanted to fix it. And so there's a part of me that can't live with not being able to fix something that's broken. In very many ways, I think, I'm sure I'm not unique in that sense. I'm sure a lot of people have that same sentiment, but it's just like the Jack Shepherd character. He couldn't not fix people. He couldn't not fix what was wrong. And anytime that ever happened to me, I still dream about that car to this day because it's something that I never finished. And I'll never get the chance back.
Do you feel like, looking back, do you know what you could do to fix it today?
No.
Like if, no?
Okay. Well, yes.
Like if you walked out of this room right now, could you go set in motion?
I knew what was the next level, which was basically to tear apart that car along with all electronics and to remove the quote-unquote brain of it and rewire that car entirely with a third-party aftermarket race computer.
When did you come up with this, or did you know before you got
it existed? The computer itself would have cost $3,000, and then the wiring of it would have cost at least another $3,000. And
how much time would it take to?
Months.
Okay.
You know.
So you knew going into when you were giving up the car that you knew you had a plan.
I knew that there was always something more that you could do.
Okay.
There's never an end to it, though. That's the thing.
Yeah.
With these type of things, whether it was Counter-Strike or whether it was a car, there's never an end to, I can try this. I can do this. What if this? And that's the obsessing part of it that I love. I love that there's no end to the solutions or the potential solutions to the problem that we're facing. And which is probably what one of the things that makes me a pretty good photographer is because I can troubleshoot it. In fact, I love it. I love that there's a challenge to overcome. But there's that other side of the sword or the other edge of the blade where you can get cut because you don't know when to quit. And you're still pouring money good after bad. It's like chasing a stock that is losing value day by day.
When
and going,
do you make that decision?
Well, now it's cheaper. Let's buy more.
And at that point, is it quitting? Like if you know that the right move is to stop, that's not really quitting. It feels like it.
It feels like it.
Yeah.
Knowing when to quit is really important because there's that whole Freakonomics episode that was about how when people quit what they hated doing or that they, whether it was a marriage or a bad job or a bad situation, they were happier as a result of it. I was happier that I didn't have to deal with it.
You let go of that burden at the time.
It was a huge monkey off my back. But you have to understand, this is a monkey that you'll never get back.
Yeah.
Also,
yeah.
Right? Whether or not you like that monkey, it's a monkey you'll never see again.
Right.
Okay, so you have to be ready to say goodbye forever.
I think that's what people do in relationships too. They'll hold on and hold on for hope that it's going to turn around.
You have to know this is over for real.
Yeah.
And I get that. And I'm okay with that because the flip side of it is you say goodbye too early. Like when I didn't write this down earlier, but this is a really good example. I had a golden retriever that lived to be 13 and a half years old. And she had bladder cancer, a huge tumor that was growing inside her bladder, and it was terminal. It was terminal even if we decided to operate because it was 50-50, the bladder cancer would grow back. And then after surgery, so we didn't do the surgery because looking at the odds, it was 50-50 she would get the cancer again. And
she'd have to go through all that.
Chemo every week. After the surgery, and as a 13 and a half year old, it's not something that you want to subject that dog to.
They don't know. They're signing up for something they didn't know they're signing up for.
I mean, some rough math puts her at 91 years old in human years.
Yeah.
It's not exact, but that's kind of what you. So,
and how
would
the body's
I subject
gonna react
my
to that?
Would I subject my 91 year old grandmother, grandfather to that to get the surgery and then go through chemo and then have a 50-50 chance
that it comes back,
so we decided not to. And as a cancer and as a bladder tumor grew, she was peeing blood, She was then peeing every like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, she couldn't even stand up. So this dragged on. So the time when we found that she had had cancer to the time when we finally put her down was about 2 to 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the reason I bring the story up. When I decided today's the day, it was I think the first day when she couldn't even stand up anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. She stopped eating. When you stop eating, there's not much time left.
Right.
And at first she stopped eating her regular dog food. Then I, you know, tried to entice her with the soft dog food, which is the canned dog food, which, you know, to dogs, they love that stuff.
Right.
Then she stopped eating that. Then I started feeding her regular food, human food, which I never did. She stopped eating that. And finally, I was just giving her French fries. And when she stopped eating even French fries, I was like, this is it, dude. She's
making a decision. Whether she knows it or not, if she's making a conscious decision, I don't want anything else. I'm good. Yeah. This is it.
Well, when you're in that much pain where you can't eat
french fries anymore, yeah.
That's bad. That's real bad. And she had lost, she'd gone down like 25 pounds from 60 some odd pounds. She was down to like 30 something pounds. So I was like, well, I don't think she's going to last much longer. I took her to the vet. The vet agreed with me. And then on a Monday morning, because we'd waited that weekend to put her down, Monday morning, we put her down. Immediately after that, I regretted the decision because I was like, because then I'd second guess myself. I immediately started second guessing myself, thinking maybe she had more time. You know, maybe she wasn't in that much pain. Maybe she could have done better. Maybe we could have operated, you know, or whatever. But the logical side of me was like, dude, come on. That was it. That was the right decision.
When you're taking emotions out of it.
Yeah.
You look at
when
the
When you
paper.
Take it and remove the
emotions.
If it wasn't
emotions, your dog.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the right decision. But you can't help when you're emotionally invested.
Yeah.
That same thing with the car.
Mm-hmm.
There's always something left that you could do.
It's part of you.
And you can't give up. Giving up is surrender. Giving up is failure. And we've all, you know, every one of us has been groomed to learn surrender's not an option. Giving up is forever or whatever. There's all these thousands of sayings that you know, you should never give up. You should persist. Try mm-hmm. again, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so I know to this day that now that the pain is gone, it's mm-hmm. logically the right decision. Just like with the car, it was the right decision to pull the plug. Otherwise, you don't know how much more money you would have thrown at it. But it's the other thing, the other side of it is you never get that chance again because it doesn't come around. She'll never be alive again. The car will never be in your possession. You'll never get another chance to solve that problem. So sometimes you do wonder. Sometimes you do wonder whether or not if I hadn't flown yesterday, I would have never crashed. Well, then I would be guessing, second guessing and going home. Sure, with a perfectly intact plane, but
Johnny could have flown. That's the question. Right. Like, he gets to fly another day,
or he could have lost a $300 plane.
Yeah,
and destroyed it. And I don't want to make this about him not flying because I think everybody has their own, decision to make. It's their prerogative and their own backstory. It's their own experiences.
Sure.
And in my situation, I'm a gambler. I have to do it. And it's funny because actually there's so much as it relates to photography, but because this one podcast, this single podcast has been so long, just get to this point, just to get it to come around to where it coincides with photography. I'm going to break it here, even though I have historically gone on for 2 hours, but I'm going to break it here so that I can make the second part of the podcast just photography. So you guys stay tuned and then hopefully click to the next one.